Since the 9th century AD, Russian history has been shaped by social, political, and physical extremes. The sheer enormity of the Russian landmass, over 6.5 million square miles, combined with a rudimentary infrastructure and ethnic diversity, have frustrated domestic ruler and foreign invader alike. Russia's historic vulnerability created in her leaders an almost paranoid concern for centralized control and a strong military. The use of foreign weapons, as well as the hiring of foreign mercenaries, had a long history in Russia. By the 17th century, imported weapons were supplemented by limited domestic production. The flintlock mechanism, originating in France in the early 1600s, was the most advanced method yet devised of producing a spark to ignite black powder in small arms. For more than 200 years, the muzzle-loading flintlock musket was the dominant infantry weapon in all armies.
This is an example of a very early flintlock military-type musket of about 1650, which would be the reign of the Tsar Alexis. This specific piece was made in the Moscow Armory. Only very wealthy people could afford firearms in those early days, so they were mostly more ornate. For a weapon this early to be as plain as it is rather unusual.
In 1682, a new Tsar took the reins of power in Russia. At 6 feet 7 inches, he was a man of commanding presence. He is remembered today not for his physical stature, but for sweeping social reform. His name was Peter the Great, and he changed Russia forever. Peter embraced Western European culture. He established a new capital on the Neva River, St. Petersburg, which became a symbol of Russia's new enlightenment. But more than anything else, Peter the Great was motivated by warfare. His overriding priority was to make Russia militarily self-sufficient. Prior to Peter's reign, Russia's imperial first-line infantry was composed mostly of German mercenaries, who enjoyed considerable prestige and influence. Peter stripped the mercenaries of their political power and created Russia's first national army. The first imperial ordnance plant was established at Tula in 1712. It is still producing weapons for the Russian military. Many of these are on display at the famous Tula Arms Museum.
When Peter the Great founded the first regular army in Russia, at first he equipped this army with foreign weapons mainly. Then he decided to build national gun factories because foreign weapons were 10 times more expensive than Russian. Already in 1714, the factory gave its first production.
At the time of Peter's death in 1725, his empire could deploy some 200,000 men, dressed in regulation uniforms and armed with Russian-made muskets. By the late 18th century, the Industrial Revolution in Europe had advanced gunsmithing to the point where flintlocks were being mass-produced for large standing armies. The first Russian muskets featuring interchangeable parts were issued in 1798, during the reign of Paul I. The pistols and muskets used by opposing armies during the Napoleonic era were basically identical. And although tactically superior to anything used before, these weapons were still inherently inaccurate and unreliable. The flintlock loading process was broken down into a series of precise movements, which were carried out in unison, often to the sound of drum rolls. But there was never a guarantee that the flint would spark and the musket fire.
There was no fundamental difference between Russian and foreign small arms. Flintlocks failed to fire in about 50% of cases when used en masse.
Four rounds per minute were possible until muskets became fouled with black powder residue. Then, Even well-drilled soldiers were lucky to get off one round every 45 seconds. Field commanders were inclined to hold fire until the enemy got within 30 or 40 yards. At such close range, the massed volley of an infantry battalion on the line, nearly 1,000 men, was murderous. Volleys of artillery fire completed the carnage. A single day of combat could leave tens of thousands of dead and wounded on the battlefield. A measure of the sheer scale of Napoleonic warfare. On September 7th, 1812, the army of Tsar Alexander I established positions near a village 75 miles west of Moscow. Its mission was to halt Napoleon's advance into the Russian heartland. Borodino was the largest single-day battle of the Napoleonic era, involving nearly 250,000 troops. One-third of those, 30,000 French and 44,000 Russians, were killed or wounded. And while technically a French victory, Borodino was Napoleon's bloodiest day. The Russians withdrew with their army and their will to fight intact. In the end, it was Napoleon who would succumb to Russia's great expanse and unforgiving climate. He was not the first, nor would he be the last. For most of the world, the reign of the smoothbore musket came to an end in the mid-19th century. By the start of the American Civil War, two developments had revolutionized small arms accuracy. Claude Meunier's conical-shaped musket ball, commonly called the mini ball in the United States, and grooved or rifled musket barrels. Maximum effective ranges increased from 150 yards or less to 500 yards or more. In addition, the flintlock had given way to the percussion cap, providing simplified loading and more reliable ignition. The Russians were late in adopting new weapons, particularly the rifle. This proved to be a fatal handicap during the Crimean War with the British from 1853 to 1856. The primary Russian weapon was the percussion smoothbore.
The model 1845 was the first percussion musket manufactured in quantity for the Russian army. And on this specific specimen, it's very clear that it was used in the Crimea because the wood is all painted black. The sun would literally shine off of the nice polished stocks of the muskets, so they had to paint them black in order to keep from being picked out by snipers. I bought one of these rifles at an English auction one time. It was a Crimean War bringback, and it was all painted black like that. And I thought, well, what kind of an idiot would do that? So I spent days very carefully taking all this black paint off of this musket. And then the next time I talked to my friend in Finland, he said, you idiot. He said, they did that on purpose. Now you have just taken away a little bit of the history of that weapon.
In the Crimea, Russian infantry were generally outclassed by the British and their rifled muskets. The one rifle in the Russian inventory was issued exclusively to sharpshooters.
The first rifled weapon to be adopted by the Russian army was foreign, and it was the Belgian Stutzer of 1843. All in all, about 20,500 Belgian Stutzers were operational with the Russian army.
The Stutzer featured a distinctive brass-handled Roman sword-type bayonet and a cleverly designed compartment in the stock called a patchbox. It held wads or patches of cloth, which secured the distinctive bullet inside the rifled barrel.
The interesting thing about it was that it only had two grooves, and the original bullet was a round ball with a belt around it, looking exactly like the planet Saturn. which is a little bit unusual, you must admit. So the Russians saw this, they loved the rifle, but they said, no, round ball with a belt on it, this is stupid. So what they did, they pointed the bullet. They took away at least two sections of the belt, leaving only two ears with a pointed bullet. And they got the most fantastic accuracy out of this you can imagine.
Ironically, it was the American Civil War that would become a proving ground for many European innovations. Although largely fought with muzzle-loading percussion rifles, the conflict also saw the most widespread use of breech-loading rifles to date. Between 1867 and 1869, the Russians tried several different methods of converting their muzzle-loading rifles. One of the first was the so-called needle fire system, offered by a Swedish gunsmith, Carl.
This Carl needle rifle was adopted in 1868 by the Russians out of panic more than anything else. The needle fire system, which literally used a needle instead of a firing pin. The needle went into the cartridge and detonated the cartridge through a percussion cap at the base of the bullet, which means that the needle had to be in the powder at the time that it was ignited.
Consequently, even before the Carl rifles were out the door, the Russians looked to another system, invented by a Bohemian, Sylvester Krinka. It featured a hinged breech block on which was mounted the firing pin. The most significant feature of the Krinka was its metallic cartridge, designed by an American, Colonel Hiram Berdan. Berdan had commanded an elite regiment of northern sharpshooters during the Civil War.
The revolutionary aspect of this cartridge was the fact that it was made of drawn brass, which, when fired, would expand to fill the chamber of the weapon, and consequently the gases had nowhere to escape except forward through the muzzle. This is the first time you had a practical breech loader that didn't spit gases or burning powder back in the face of the man firing the weapon. And it was all because of that solid drawn brass metallic cartridge.
At the time, a group of Russian ordnance specialists led by a Colonel Alexander Gorlov were in the United States examining modern breech-loading small arms.
It was a clever decision to go abroad, in America, and to find there the best version for our army. Because, you know, in the Civil War, a great number of new versions appeared, weapons.
Hiram Berdan's success with the brass cartridge fostered a long association with the Russians, one that would achieve significant milestones in ammunition and firearm design. Berdan's first breech-loading rifle had a trapdoor arrangement and was originally chambered for an experimental caliber 60 cartridge. But the Russians understood that a smaller caliber meant higher velocity and increased accuracy.
He came all the way down to caliber 45. That means he cut down 25% of the bulk of his bullet. Then the Russians came along and they said, we think that we could do a little better with this cartridge by bottlenecking it. Then you would have an even smaller caliber, but still with the larger powder charge. And it worked a miracle. The Russian-designed Berdan cartridge for the Berdan rifle, which was adopted by Russia as the Berdan number one, was so accurate with that caliber 42 cartridge. These rifles were made by Colt specifically for the sharpshooter battalions of the Russian army.
In the meantime, Berdan had modified his rifle, replacing the trapdoor mechanism with a turn bolt. In 1870, he sold the manufacturing rights to the Tsar. The Berdan II became Russia's first breech-loading, single-shot, bolt-action rifle. Many of these rifles saw action in the Russo-Turkish War of 1877. This example, made at Tula, is number 1 million. But the Russian buying spree in America was not confined to rifles. Gorlov purchased 90 Gatling guns and obtained a license for their manufacture. In Russia, they became known as Gorlov guns. The Russians were also in the market for handguns, and they found what they wanted at the Smith & Wesson Company in Springfield, Massachusetts, a caliber 44 revolver called the Model 3. It was large and powerful.
Well, this was a pretty nice revolver for the late 1860s. That was only 4 years after the Civil War had finished. And General Gorlov took one look at this, and he said, I like it. He said, I want to buy some of these for our cavalry.
The 44 Smith & Wesson, stamped with Cyrillic markings and substantially modified to Russian specifications, was the first revolver issued in large numbers to the Russian army. Eventually, over 250,000 of the so-called Russian models were acquired. In 1895, they were replaced by a small and somewhat curious firearm designed by a Belgian named Emil Nagant. His caliber 30 revolver featured a gas seal that was unique in many ways.
The 1895 Nagant revolver was an exceptionally reliable weapon. At the time, it was the best in the world. It had a number of structural differences. When you cock the hammer and fire the revolver, the cylinder moves forward, thus completely sealing the chamber and blocking the escape of gases. When you pull the trigger, the hammer strikes the primer and causes the shot.
The high-velocity 7.62 cartridge for the Nagant revolver was also unusual in that the bullet was positioned entirely inside the brass case.
What they were looking for was attaining the maximum amount of pressure from the propellant that was in the cartridge. They wanted the brass to expand right to the mouth of the cylinder.
It was simply referred to as the Nagan, a word in Russian that became synonymous with revolver. Issued in many variations, the Nagant remained in production until World War II. Russia was the last major power to transition from revolvers to semi-automatic pistols. But historically, sidearms were considered secondary. Rifles remained the basic concern of the Russian general staff. And in 1891, the Russians adopted a rifle that would serve with distinction in two world wars, a firearm that would come to symbolize the two extremes of Russian society, royalty and revolution. The introduction of the percussion cap in the mid-1800s made possible the self-contained brass cartridge. The cartridge, in turn, stimulated development of repeating or magazine-fed rifles. By 1890, the advent of nitrocellulose-based, or smokeless powder, provided cartridges with much higher muzzle velocities and longer effective ranges. These advances rapidly overtook firearms development. Between 1890 and 1900, armies throughout the world adopted bolt-action magazine-fed rifles, which fired lead bullets from bottlenecked brass cartridges. These powerful long guns could deliver aimed fire at ranges of over 1,000 yards. In Russia, experiments with the new ammunition had yielded superior ballistic results with a 7.62 or caliber 30 cartridge. Numerous proposals for rifles using 7.62 ammunition were submitted for evaluation. Eventually, a design from Colonel Sergei Mosin of the Tula Arsenal, was combined with one from Emil Nagant of Belgium, the creator of the Nagant revolver. The result was the Mosin Nagant rifle, model 1891.
This was a very fine turning bolt action, which didn't look really beautiful, but it's almost indestructible. It is extremely reliable.
Due to a shortage of production facilities, the first 500,000 Mosin Nagant rifles were made under contract in France.
Russia's vastness, the huge population, the number of troops that they could put in the field, combined to make it almost impossible for the arms manufacturers to keep up.
Mass production began in Russia in 1894. This is the first Tula-made example. In 1908, the Russians adopted the most significant advance in ammunition for their new rifle.
The Germans came up with what they called a Spitzgeschoss, which in German means pointed bullet. It was aerodynamic and almost totally eliminated wind resistance.
Dragoon and carbine models of the Mosin Nagant with shorter barrels were eventually produced. But without question, the smallest version of the Mosin Nagant was this perfect half-scale example, using half-scale ammunition. It was made for Alexei, the only son of Tsar Nicholas II, heir to the throne. The Tsar wanted his son to be well-schooled in military science. At the outbreak of war in 1914, so many rifles were needed that orders for over a million Model 1891s were placed with U.S. manufacturers. But in October 1917, Russia's struggle with the Germans and Turks on the Eastern Front ground to a halt. The country was convulsed in revolution. Nicholas was forced to abdicate and sent into exile in Siberia. On July 17, 1918, the Bolsheviks, fearful that opposing white Russian forces would free the Tsar, murdered Nicholas and his entire family. The Romanov dynasty, that had ruled the Russian people since 1613, had come to a definitive and violent end. The Mosin Nagant rifle continued in production in various forms through 1944, a legacy of both Tsarist and Soviet Russia. The revolution had a profound effect on the country's small arms production. In a strange irony, the communist regime, cut off from most foreign sources, made self-sufficiency in weaponry a high priority, just as Peter the Great had more than 200 years before. By 1928, firearms were included in the grand scheme for industrializing the USSR. Though the Mosin Nagant rifle remained the standard infantry's small arm, designers were looking to increase the volume of fire for the individual soldier. Firepower would become a continuing theme in Soviet small arms development. Even prior to the revolution, in 1916, Vladimir Fedorov, a seminal figure in Russian firearms history, developed the first prototype avtomat, or machine rifle. This revolutionary weapon combined the properties of a repeating rifle with those of an automatic submachine gun. The Fedorov Avtomat used a smaller Japanese Arisaka 6.5 cartridge with a 25-round box magazine.
This Avtomat was not supposed to be practical for long distances, so you didn't need a really powerful cartridge. On the other hand, if you had a powerful cartridge, you also had more weight, and you needed more space in the mechanism to accommodate that larger cartridge. So a smaller cartridge is always better from a design standpoint.
In the end, the Fedorov Avtomat, the precursor of the modern assault rifle, proved too complex for its time. It was impossible to control on full automatic. Russian designers concentrated on semi-automatic rifles, standardizing on the 7.62x54 rimmed cartridge used in the Mosin Nagant rifle. Most failed due to excessive recoil or feeding and extraction problems associated with the full power cartridge. In 1938, a self-loading rifle, the SVT, designed by Fedor Tokarev, was adopted for service. Almost immediately, the weapon was embroiled in a bitter professional dispute that was resolved only with the intervention of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. Stalin knew and liked Tokarev and championed the tactical advantages the rifle, at least in theory, provided. Russia was on the verge of war. But it was not what Stalin had planned for when he signed a non-aggression pact with Hitler's Germany in August 1939. Neither Stalin nor the Soviet people had any idea of the struggle that lay before them. In June 1941, when the Germans launched Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia, the Red Army was armed primarily with Model 1891 Mosin Nagant rifles. Ironically, the gun's most significant period of service was achieved after it was technically obsolete as a frontline weapon. Unlike the SVT, the Mosin Nagant could digest the poorest quality ammunition and would keep firing as long as the riflemen had the strength to work the bolt. For all its admirable qualities, it could not provide a high volume of fire. And Soviet designs for rapid-fire semi-automatic rifles, primarily the Tokarev SVT-38 and SVT-40, had proved disappointing.
The Tokarev 1938 and 1940 rifles were not quite efficient in dust and dirt or a rapid change of temperature and failed to prove reliable enough under battlefield conditions.
Between the wars, the Soviets had experimented with small-caliber, high-velocity submachine guns. But conservative army leaders, clinging to the idea of individual marksmanship, never regarded them as particularly useful. Now, in the midst of a national emergency, it was decided that the bullet-spraying submachine gun, however small, would become a major fighting weapon. Ultimately, the Red Army fielded more submachine guns than any other country during the Second World War.
The priority was, what is the quickest and cheapest thing we can make? And the answer to that was submachine guns. Rifles demanded a specialist rifle factory. Ivan's garage and Joe's engineering workshops, they were all put on to making submachine guns as hard as they could go.
In 1934, Vasily Degtyarev had designed the PPD, the first submachine gun adopted by the Soviet military. But numerous design and production defects gave reason for senior army officials to withdraw it from service in 1939. Degtyarev substantially modified the gun, creating the PPD-40. A significant feature of the new version was its chrome-lined barrel. This refinement made the barrel nearly impervious to neglect. It is a feature the Russians have continued to use on practically all of their automatic and selective fire weapons. However, the Degtyarev PPD-40 was never produced in large numbers. It would fall to another design by Georgi Shpagin to face the German onslaught. Shpagin's gun, the PPSH-41, was optimized for mass production. Later versions featured a 35-round box magazine. there was no selector switch. It fired only on full auto. It was the first Soviet small arm to use stamped and welded parts, requiring less machining time for completion. The Pepeshah, as it was called by the Russians, was ridiculed for being crude and resembling a farm implement, but over 6 million were made. By 1944, one company in every infantry regiment was armed entirely with PPSHs. Disregarding their own casualties, swarm attacks with submachine guns became a favored Soviet tactic. Images of Red Army soldiers brandishing their Pepeshahs became an icon of what the Russians call the Great Patriotic War. In 1942, based on the extraordinary success of the PPSH, the Soviet leadership issued specifications for a new submachine gun. It had to be simpler to operate and easier to assemble than the PPSH, but no less effective. Most parts had to be stamped or pressed from hot-rolled steel. Excessive trimming and shaping was not permitted. And the average production time was not to exceed 3.5 hours. Only one gun met all the requirements, the PPS.
You've got a big hammer press, and you put a piece of bare sheet metal in it, and it comes down, and wham, and there you have the part. Simple as that, and probably does it more quickly than it takes me to tell about it.
The PPS would play an extraordinary role in the Great Patriotic War. By early September 1941, Russia's second largest city, Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, had been completely encircled by two German armies. In October, the population began to die of starvation. For 900 days, the city endured constant air and artillery bombardment. Supplies were cut off, except for a treacherous corridor across frozen Lake Ladoga. Food was severely rationed. Within the city's defense perimeter, workers at the Voskhov Instrument Factory produced the first PPS submachine guns under the personal direction of the designer, Alexei Sudayev. Guns went straight from the factory to the front lines. The first field trials for the weapon were carried out in combat. Fortunately, the PPS succeeded from the beginning, and the weapon became a vital factor in the defense of the city. By the time the Red Army broke the siege in January 1944, over 1 million Russian civilians had been killed or starved to death. Their story was transformed into an almost mythic symbol of Soviet tenacity and resolve. If ever a particular event was identified with a particular firearm, it would certainly be the Siege of Leningrad and the PPS. Lesson of the Great Patriotic War, from the Soviet infantry commander's point of view, was that troops arrived at the front lines rapidly and at relatively close range to the enemy. They adopted a cartridge reflecting the realities of the modern battlefield. The 7.62x39, the so-called intermediate cartridge, delivered more range and stopping power than a submachine gun, but less than the Mosin-Nagant battle rifle. The weapon most closely associated with the Russian intermediate cartridge became famous throughout the world. It was known variously as the Avtomat Kalashnikova, the AK-47, the AK, or simply, the Kalashnikov, after its chief designer, Mikhail Kalashnikov. a one-time tank sergeant and self-taught engineer. If versatility is a measure of importance, the AK-47 is arguably the most influential small arm of the post-war era. 30 years after Vladimir Fedorov's premature automat, the AK defined the modern selective fire assault rifle.
Automatic, semi-automatic. Loaded from the bottom.
And became a symbol of revolutionary movements worldwide.
Pull the charging handle. Full automatic.
The basic design of the AK-47 has set the tone for assault rifles for just about the entire world. It was rugged, it was reliable, it was what we used to say GI proof. It was almost impossible to break it. And for a conscript army like the Soviet Union had, and for guerrilla fighters from Vietnam, you could throw it in the dirt, you could throw it in the mud, and soak it in water. And it just kept on going. It never quit. It was the epitome of reliability.
The AK also symbolized a new emphasis in Russian military doctrine.
The Soviets envisioned massed fires for suppression and then overrunning with infantry fighting vehicles. For the BMP specifically, for the BMP had firing ports that were adaptable to the AKM rifle. And the troops inside could actually fight, theoretically at least, from the vehicle. The notion of accurate aimed fire that was so traditional, especially in the U.S. Army and in the Marine Corps particularly, was changed by the assault rifle.
Kalashnikov's influence eventually extended to virtually every Soviet infantry's small arm. This sniper rifle, the SVD, is a highly modified Kalashnikov. Adopted in 1963, it's the first dedicated Soviet sniper rifle since the scope-mounted Mosin Nagants of the 1940s. To accept the large and powerful 7.62x54 rimmed cartridge, SVD designer Yevgeny Dragunov provided a 10-round magazine, a longer, heavier barrel, and essentially dampened the AK's receiver mechanism. The bolt was replaced and the gas piston modified for less recoil, thereby keeping the target in the sights for a quick follow-up shot.
The Russian 7.62x54R is the oldest military cartridge in existence. If you're looking for range and penetration, you can reach out and touch someone with it, and that's why it continues to be used in sniper rifles and in machine guns.
Perhaps the most graphic demonstration of the Kalashnikov's adaptability occurred when the Soviet military ordered a reduction in the caliber of its light infantry weapons. The result, for all practical purposes, was an AK modified for the Soviet 5.45x39 cartridge. The older AK-47 provided no less than 53% of the parts for the new AK-74, introduced in Red Square on May Day, 1977. In contrast to the decade-long upheaval the M16 caused in the United States Army, the 5.45 cartridge and the AK-74 were seamlessly adopted by the Soviet Army. A first in the history of military small arms. Now, 50 years after it transformed infantry fighting tactics, the Kalashnikov assault rifle has been challenged by a new contender, designed by Gennady Nikonov. The AN-94 is revolutionary in every way.
In essence, you have a rifle that has an operating system that is both recoil-operated and gas-operated. You can see the barrel actually reciprocating. What you essentially get is two bullets being launched with a single impulse before the recoil of the rifle can actually reach the shooter. Those two bullets are on their way downrange. What this does is increase the probability of hit by about 1.5 times.
The Russians may have ultimately solved the fundamental problem with assault rifles, first encountered by Fedorov in 1916, controllability and accuracy.
It really is a state-of-the-art rifle. There's nobody in the world who has a more advanced infantry combat rifle than the Russians at this point.
With the collapse of the communist bloc, the future of the sophisticated AN-94 is in question, and not for technical reasons, as was the case with Fedorov's Avtomat.
They really can't afford to build the AN-94 in the numbers that they truly need because they don't have the money for it. We see a large number of prototypes and various and sundry types of small arms that are being developed, but they're not selling. The small arms market in the world is flat. You can buy a used AKM in sub-Saharan Africa for less than $50. That's the payback that the Russians get for flooding the world market with AKs back during the Cold War. But it's market economics at work.
Providing guns for Russia's military has been a challenge for generations of czars and communists alike. But the problems that now beset the once thriving armories are unlike anything ever encountered in the closed and sealed world of the former Soviet Union.
We have those old forces of engineers, and they continue to work today. They build weapons, design weapons today. Though today you know the designer bureaus are in a poor condition. Nevertheless, we believe that we can today build perfect weapons, though it's difficult to do now.
Today, nearly 300 years after Peter the Great dragged Russia into the modern world, her military is equipped with, some would say, the most effective small arms currently in use, at a time when the country is on the brink of total chaos. It is an irony not lost on the common Russian soldier, who has always carried the weight of uncertainty upon his shoulders.